Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast.
At Florida State, we won national championships and ACC championships.
Back to some basics, consistency in what we're doing. Guys get real banged and bruised, work in a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success so you know something I can really do this.
Welcome back to the Unconquered Podcast, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Back after a fairly extended delay in which there really wasn't a whole lot to talk about. I'm not going to waste anybody's time, especially not my own, if there's just not much going on in the realm of in the world of Florida State football. Obviously, could have talked about some Florida State basketball, but I don't think anybody wants to talk about that right now. So let's get to a few things that we can that are noteworthy enough to discuss that have come up since the last episode, over the first week of spring practice and through off-season workouts and so on. Should be a relatively short episode. There's still really not a whole lot to talk about. I mean, they still haven't had a full scrimmage in the spring, and we really won't know much until some of the reports start coming out about what happened in that. But that doesn't mean that there's nothing to discuss, so we'll go ahead and discuss some of the things that have happened since National Signing Day, since our last episode took place a little bit after that. First thing actually that I want to discuss is something that I could have mentioned in that last episode, but that wasn't really relevant to the recruiting class so much, but plenty of relevance for next year. And that's a little bit of discussion about the departure of Travis Rudolph and the thinking behind that. Interestingly, I heard through the grapevine, basically. It got back to me that that Kermit Whitfield at one of the All-Star games was talking about Rudolph's decision and basically was asked, you know, why Rudolph decided to go pro. And Kermit's response was very interesting. I think something that that Florida State fans will be very interested in hearing, and that's that. Well, to be honest, we talked about that on the flight or on the way back from the Orange Bowl. You know, basically, he said Rudolph kind of looked at him and was like, "Yeah, you know, I know it's over." Basically, he knew that. His opportunities to be basically a number one or number two receiver were just not going to be there next year because of the talent of the guys behind him. And I know that there are going to be some people out there who are skeptical about this, but this was apparently a discussion that was being had among some of the upperclassmen. And basically Whitfield said, you know, listen, we ain't stupid. We know what was behind us. And those guys were finally starting to get it. And Rudolph knew that coming back next year, he wasn't really going to get the opportunity to improve his draft stock a whole heck of a lot more, and he knew that he wasn't going to get any faster or bigger. So at that point, the best decision is to go ahead and go pro and go ahead and acknowledge that those youngsters are going to take reps away from him. And here's probably the most interesting piece of this. This was a quote that got back to me about this, which Kermit said, which was, if you think Tate and Nooney are good, wait till you see Gavin. He said, that guy is a different level. And once he figures it out a little bit, then, you know, he's going to be completely like, he's a whole different animal. He is special. And again, that says a lot. I mean, that validates some of the other things that we've talked about on this podcast previously. It validates some of the other reports that we've heard going back to when the freshman first got on campus last fall. But very interesting. And it makes a lot of sense. And actually, if you look at the performance of the Florida State wide receivers at the NFL Combine, and, you know, it's worth mentioning this. For several reasons, but you know, a lot of Florida State fans and even some media out there complained a lot about Florida State's wide receivers over the last year or two. But the thing that's striking to me is how many teams other than Florida State had three wide receivers at the NFL Combine in 2017. I'll wait. Still waiting. Yeah, I don't know of any others either. So that in itself is interesting. And then when you look at what those receivers did, how they measured out, what they did in drills and so on at the combine, it's very apparent that Florida State really maxed out what they could get out of those players. They really did not put up impressive physical numbers. You look at, you know, Travis Rudolph running in the mid 4.6s at just under 6 foot. None of the receivers being big at all. Obviously, we knew that. Kermit Whitfield running a disappointing time, but, you know, if anything, he may have been tightened up on that. I'll be interested to see what his on-campus time is going to be at Pro Day. But either way, you know, you're looking at 4.6 times from Travis Rudolph and Bobo Wilson. You're looking at a 4.45 from a 5'7.5", 5'8" guy in Kermit Whitfield. Florida State maxed out what those guys could do. And actually, if you then go back and you look at what those guys looked like in the receiver drills, they were among the very best in the combine in doing the wide receiver drills, running routes and doing the things that actually you have to do as far as position drills at the combine. And it just goes to show that Florida State, as far as the wide receiver position, has been very well coached. Lawrence Dawsey did a good job with these guys. It's just that he did not have a Kelvin Benjamin. He did not have, an Amari Cooper or Sammy Watkins or a Mike Williams or whatever among that bunch. Florida State has been going with really less talent at the wide receiver position. And yes, that boils down to recruiting. But Florida State's been operating with less talent at the wide receiver position the last couple of years, and they maxed that position out with what those guys could do. I'm not sure that Bobo Wilson gets invited to the combine from many places other than Florida State. I don't know that he gets developed like he did at Florida State at many other places, quite frankly. You know, a guy his size running in the 4.6s is not going to get that combine invite from a lot of different places. So that just goes to show where Florida State was at the last couple of years. And now you can look forward to what they have on campus, and they have restocked that cupboard. There may be a player or two, a body or two short with Harrison leaving campus and Lane changing positions and so on. But in terms of the actual talent on the roster, this is by far the most talented group they've had, certainly since 2013. And I think you can make a case that this group is top to bottom more talented than that 2013 wide receiver group was, with Kelvin Benjamin, Kenny Shaw, and Rashad Green. When you look at Keith Gavin, at Auden Tate, at Noonie Murray, at George Campbell, and Phillips also there as the fifth guy, that group is as good as Florida State's had on campus in recent memory, player for player, talent for talent. And, you know, all of them, except for Noonie, with really good size, and all of them really, except for Phillips, can really run. Tate's not a burner, but, you know, again, for his size, moves really well. So, you know, that's a very talented group, and now that they've had the time to actually learn to play the position, and the wide receiver position is one that takes some time to learn how to play in college, even in easier systems, the wide receiver position is very different in college than it is in high school, as we've talked about previously. These guys should be stepping into right around the time when you expect them to take that step forward. So I'm expecting a really, really good year from that wide receiver group in 2017, something we're going to continue to discuss. And again, I'm going to be getting some reports here and there about how these guys are doing, and obviously health is going to matter and all that. But we'll keep tabs on this. But I would expect this class to be very, very good, this group of wide receivers to be very, very good. And that's without DJ Matthews and Tamorian Terry. That is, if Terry does make it on campus. But that's without DJ Matthews, who also potentially could contribute. He probably would have contributed had he been an early enrollee, but by not being an early enrollee, it makes it really difficult to actually contribute at that position in college. You usually need to be an early enrollee to learn how to run the routes, to play in various spots and do all the things that you need to do to be able to play college wide receiver. But you know, he's a smart guy, and it's possible that with some summer work and all that, it's possible that by mid year and so on, he winds up doing some things. But you know, I think the other thing to remember here is how much that 2013 recruiting class really killed Florida State. And we need to keep coming back to this because the year when Florida State lost six assistant coaches in the middle of the recruiting process, in the middle of recruiting season, that really that class is what cost Florida State the capacity to build off of that national championship with sustained championship level excellence. You look at that 2013 class, and that pumped the brakes on Florida State's progress. And it took another couple years to restock the cupboard to where they're getting back to that 2013-2014 level of talent. Because when those guys from the 2013 and 2014 team, when those guys went pro, many of them early, without the 2013 class being a solid class, and yes, you had Jalen Ramsey and you had Matthew Thomas, who's finally starting to earn dividends there. There just weren't very many players in that class that were able to step in and fill roles, and so it wound up really costing Florida State a lot of progress because of not being able to sustain the same level of recruiting year over year. And the 2014 class, you know, there were some issues as well there in terms of not being quite as strong. And that, of course, was to some degree the result of all the problems that Florida State was having in terms of image. They're pretty much past that at this point. And you can see that with the latest classes. And quite frankly, when you go down roster, you know, player for player on this roster for the 2017 roster, with the exception of the quarterback position, which is obviously a big deal, the 2017 team is more talented top to bottom than the 2013 team is. I know it sounds crazy, but take a look down the list and you'll start to notice that that's actually probably true. Still some weaknesses, and we're about to address that here in the next, still some question marks, and we'll address that in the next segment, but it's worth noting that how much that 2013 class really hurt Florida State. You know, you look at Isaiah Jones was the big wide receiver in that class. Wasn't able to be on campus more than a year. Did nothing. You wind up with Kermit Whitfield and Bobo Wilson from that class. And they wind up being your guys for a few years because you're just not able to fill in with elite wide receivers for a couple of years. But now, like I said, Gavin, Campbell, Tate, and Nooney are all top shelf talents, and Phillips is no slouch either. As long as he can stay healthy. And again, the real danger with where Florida State's at receiving wise is they've got five bodies, three of which have been hurt at various points, and two of which have been hurt more than they've been healthy, Campbell and Phillips. So, you know, you do not want to be dipping into only having three or four healthy scholarship wide receivers, but that's going to be an imperative to make sure that they use the GPS technology and prayer and whatever else is necessary to make sure that that position group stays healthy, because that is one place where they're going to need to make sure that that they don't wind up losing another guy or two for the season. That would be critical. Another thing, though, that came up over the course of the break between the last podcast to this one is Jimbo Fisher had addressed during his assessment of the off-season conditioning program of the fourth quarter drills and such, the move to using some different accountability and motivation tactics with this group to try to expose lack of effort and different things like that. And I know that there were some fans out there who were sort of turned off by this, like, oh wow, you know, when you're doing this sort of thing, that's a bad sign. Because what they did is for those of you who, I'm sure most of the listeners of this show already are aware of this, but what they did is they went to a jersey scheme where basically you got a specific jersey or a specific shirt that you wore during fourth quarter drills that denoted your effort and excellence level in the prior session. So if your prior session you were giving championship level effort and execution, then you got a garnet jersey. If you were acceptable but not championship level, you know, it's basically average level, then you got a white jersey. And then if you were loafing, if you were not giving acceptable effort and execution, then you wear an orange jersey. And of course, Fisher mentioned that, you know, orange is not exactly the best color around Florida State, being the color of Florida State's three main rivals, the primary color of their three main rivals. So so that serves as a message to say, basically, if you're not pulling your weight, you're pulling against this year. You're playing on their team. You're the best player they have, sort of thing. And, you know, you had people who said, I that's a bad sign. That shows that they're not really getting through, or that they're, you know, reaching at straws. I disagree. And, you know, this gets back to going all the way back to mat drills, back when I was at Florida State years ago. Back in those days, you had every session of mat drills was graded on film. You got your grade. And then you were put in specific lines based on grades. The top grades went at the front lines, and then the ones at the back went at back lines. And then there were years where they would do things like different color shirts, and there were, you know, all sorts of things to emphasize who did what. And, you know, the 2002, if one group had an effort that was had one guy in it that the effort was a little bit less than perfect, then the entire group with that guy in it, the entire line would come back for a double session. So, I mean, there are different ways of doing this. So basically that reinforces that each member of each group is going to police itself pretty quickly. I mean, I remember doing a double session, and it was extraordinarily unpleasant. It's not something that that you want to do more than once. And, you know, you try to police your line to make sure that whoever's with you is also giving acceptable effort, and that they're not going to get you stuck. So this is the thing, is that anytime you're coaching, you have to find ways to increase accountability team-wide. And the thing that you really have to do, and this is something I talked with Jimbo Fisher back when he was a coordinator years ago, we had some conversations about this, about how important it is to have accountability that's built within the team, to get it to where a team polices itself with peer pressure, and to where a team is oriented towards excellence, to where the players on the team aren't working accountability from the coaches down, but from the players up, that the players are the ones that are actually providing that accountability. Now, the hard part is coaches have to find a way to foster that. They have to find a way to foster the player-led, peer-led accountability. And, you know, there are all sorts of things that you do. You do leadership councils. You do, you know, player-designated or player judgment on punishments for certain things. All sorts of things to try to make sure that there's buy-in, to make sure that players are invested, and that there is a sense of this is the player's project. You want to do that. But there are other times where what you have to do is you have to find ways to make sure that you use tactics of shaming, tactics of basically lumping groups together, so that, you know, it's not that people aren't punished as an individual, but people are punished as a collective, so that coaches do, from the top down, create structures such that teams then organically start to be incentivized toward positive peer pressure. And that's the kind of thing that these orange jerseys do. If you get an orange jersey, then, you know, that's a way of shaming. That's a way of demonstrating that you really aren't doing what's necessary for the team, and you don't want to be one of those guys. And quite frankly, this is one of those things that players tend to respond to. They do tend to respond to, because shame matters a lot more than just about anything else in these contexts. These are very much honor shame type, you know, cultures on teams. And Florida State's in a place with the roster where the top 75 or so guys on this roster are excellent, outstanding, including the next recruiting class. Top 75, maybe even a little bit more than that, guys are, you know, that's a really productive group of players, and a ton of high potential players. But there's definitely some fat on this roster. There's some guys that, you know, they're maybe more interested in playing football at Florida State, or being on the football team at Florida State, I should say. They're more interested in being on the football team at Florida State than actually playing football. And what you do with these sorts of things is by incorporating these orange jerseys, You find a way to expose those who aren't carrying their water. You expose those who are the, who are not doing what's expected of them, and you show that, you know, you kind of reveal the fat on the roster, if you know, both to the guy who is the fat on the roster and to all their peers who are going, come on, man. Now, if it were me, I would be assigning those jerseys to lines, like back in the Matt Drills days, not just to individuals, but basically if you assign a group of guys together based on, you know, prior grades or whatever, and position groups and so on, and then the whole line. I mean, you may have a guy who gets a great grade, gets a championship grade, but because he's in the line with the guy that didn't, all of them get orange jerseys. That's my preference. Again, that goes back to the old Matt Drill days, because it's pretty quick when you got a guy who really deserves a garnet jersey, but somebody is dragging him down to the orange jersey. Justice finds a way of working itself out. You do get some peer pressure at that point. That's my preferred way of dealing with it. But, you know, again, I think these are the sorts of things that programs have to do. And it's the sort of thing that, you know, if you look at Alabama, they're going to be doing this sort of thing, because at some level, when you are a builder coach, when you come in at the beginning, you've got fresh blood, you've got a fresh message, you've got all this. Players will follow that. But when you've had success, success is the enemy of future success. And ultimately, you have to find ways to ensure that players continue to push for success, even after that initial push. You've got to find ways to break guys out of their entitlement, and you've got to find new tools, new ways of making sure that people latch on to that message, that you've got to outwork your opponent, that you've got to be tough, and these sorts of things. Okay, now third little segment here. You've probably seen or heard a number of things over the course of the first week, and then, you know, spring break as well. So really the first 2 weeks, but really it's only covering the first week of spring practice, about a bunch of changes that have happened in, you know, at Florida State, whether in terms of personnel or scheme or recruiting preferences or whatever. And all I can say to that is, don't believe a word of it. Florida State has not changed a blessed thing when it comes to their preferences in terms of personnel and recruiting, and they haven't changed a thing in terms of scheme or how they're doing stuff in the secondary or whatever. Nothing has changed philosophically. You know, one of the things that was recently suggested was new is that Derwin James lining up at cornerback. That's a totally new thing. No, Derwin James lined up at cornerback in last spring. That was where he lined up in warmups for the spring game. And actually, and this is something that was covered in the podcast at that time. Last year, during fall camp, he was lined up at boundary corner a good bit in practice, because he was actually being considered as a possible starter at boundary corner. And it wasn't until really they became certain that it was better to have McFadden or Lewis at that position, and ultimately McFadden won that job, that they would be better off having one of those guys at the boundary corner position and having Derwin rove at safety rather than putting Derwin basically in that spot to replace Ramsey and maybe having one of those guys somewhere else. They determined that that was the best situation, but they really seriously looked at Derwin, lining Derwin up at corner last year, and he practiced at corner. This idea that Florida State lining up defensive backs at different positions and working them across the secondary and all is anything new is completely not true. They did this going back, you know, back to 2013. They did it in 2014. And really, Florida State has wanted to have five nearly interchangeable, not entirely interchangeable, but nearly interchangeable defensive backs on the field at one time since Fisher took over. And if you look at it, 2013 is basically the ideal of that. The 2013 secondary is what Florida State wants to be. Five defensive backs, all of whom can play corner. You go across that secondary, you had P.J. Williams at corner. You had Darby at corner. And then you had LaMarcus Joyner, who had played corner previously, and then he's at star, which is basically the slot corner, but playing in the box some. And then you have Brooks, who was capable of playing corner in college, and then Ramsey, who's probably the second-best corner in school history. That was your five defensive backs. And that was the ideal. That's what they've been working towards since then. They want to have that kind of group, because what that allows you to do is it keeps you from a defense, as a defense, from giving the offense any chance of finding mismatches. We talked about this a lot on this podcast. Offenses, spread offenses in particular, are always trying to find one-on-one matchups that are advantageous to the offense. So you try to find a slot receiver, or you put your number one receiver in the slot, or you motion him somewhere to try to get him against a guy who's a little bit weaker coverage player, and then, you know, you try to go to that matchup. Well, if you got five guys who can all cover like corners, five guys who can cover at an NFL level, then you say, good luck, you're not finding a mismatch. That's really where Florida State wants to be. They've wanted to be there, and, you know, they haven't had the personnel to be there since 2013. 2014, they didn't have the safeties to do that. 2015 was similar. They had great corners on the field, you know, guys you could rely on. You had Jalen Ramsey out there. But again, they didn't have safeties that could be trusted. Derwin James started to come on at the end of the year, but they did not have a pair of safeties that could be trusted across the board. So they just were not able to do what they wanted, and that, you know, teams took advantage of those safeties. And then in 2016, the same thing. Once Derwin James went down, and they again had an injury bug at the safety position, they wound up in a position where they couldn't do what they wanted to do in being able to cover across the board, as is the design of the defense. 2017, they finally have personnel-wise what they've been building back towards since 2013. And that is basically they should be able to put five guys on the field at once that can cover. And in 2013, the other thing that they had is they had two linebackers in the Smiths, Telvin and Terrence, who basically could cover like safeties. Healthy Terrence Smith, and then, of course, Telvin being outstanding. So, you know, now they're getting back to that as well, where they're going to be able to put Matthew Thomas out there, who can cover basically like a safety to some degree. I mean, he's not quite as good a coverage linebacker as, say, Telvin Smith was, but he's a little bit bigger and more complete. And then, you know, they'll be able to work in some other guys at that linebacker position on more passing downs and such to be able to get coverage from that spot as well. That's what they've been working toward. Same thing in terms of size. Florida State has been wanting long, big guys. The bigger is better rule has been how Jimbo Fisher has recruited since he took over. One thing I've heard Jimbo say a bunch is, big guy does more right by accident than the small guy often does on purpose. Because, you know, and he'll talk about it, you know, that big guy leans on y'all game and all that. And by the time you get to third, fourth quarter, that big guy, that size starts to really matter. It starts to change things down the stretch for teams, wears you down. So Florida State has always wanted huge defensive tackles, huge ends, bigger linebackers, bigger defensive backs. With a bigger is better rule, as long as they're not sacrificing mobility, as long as they're not sacrificing athleticism for it. So, you know, you have to have athleticism. There's a bare minimum there. But what they're trying to do is get as big a player as they can with that bare minimum or better athleticism. The difference is, and this goes back to, people used to think that Rick Trickett preferred smaller offensive linemen, which was always a joke. I talked to Trickett about it. He didn't prefer smaller offensive linemen. He just doesn't like fat guys. What he wants is a guy that moves like he's 290 at 330. Now, you have to start finding ways to get those guys on campus. And they've got a few of them right now that show potential to be 305, 310 that move like 280. But it takes a while to build to where you're recruiting those guys. And Florida State has finally started to get a lot of those guys on defense. You look at the defensive tackle roster going into 2017, it's insane. And it's only going to get better based on what's the early returns of the 2018 class. So, I mean, they're basically getting to where they're getting the kinds of players where they're not having to make sacrifices on size or speed or mobility to be able to have those guys on campus. Now, final things. I had you wait all the way to the end for a few tidbits from spring practice from that first week and from fourth quarter drills that have been passed along to me. A few good and a little bit of uncertainty, but first things first. One thing that I got a note about is that Bailey Hockman is better than expected and can be an FSU level quarterback. Basically, received word that, you know, The kid can play quarterback. And, you know, the source on this is generally pretty critical of this sort of thing. So so I trust my source there that that Hockman has actually looked good and has begun to has already shown that he can process and do what's expected in the Florida State offense. That's a really, really big relief if you're a Florida State fan, because Hockman may need to be the backup in 2017. And it looks like that actually may be possible. Like he may be actually prepared to come in and do that as a true freshman, thanks to being an early enrollee and being very bright. But basically, he looks like he belongs in a Florida State uniform at that position, which is a very good sign. Second thing, and this one's probably not going to be surprising, but Cam Akers is a freak. Maybe better than advertised, which is kind of hard to believe, but basically... The word is Akers is a spectacular athlete, as in that's a really, really good running back unit, and he sticks out already. One message came to me that, you know, maybe day one or getting primary carries, which we talked about before, but, you know, already starting to validate that. The guy, I'm going to go on the record, this guy may wind up better than Dalvin Cook, based on the early returns and based on what we saw in his high school tape. He came in more prepared than Cook. I'm curious to see how much of a drop-off there's going to be from Cook, because this guy, from the reports, and again, there was some caution on, well, you know, we still haven't had a scrimmage yet, but dang, this guy's really good. So that also a positive. I asked specifically about defensive ends because, you know, I'm a little concerned. I want to see what's going to happen with the replacement for DeMarcus Walker, because, you know, the guy was really good. And basically, I was told, no, you're going to be really happy with the defensive ends. DeMarcus was a beast, but the guys replacing him are really good, and it looks like they're going to be ready to go. Also a very good sign. What that basically means is that that Wilkerson and Janarius Robinson are showing good signs. And Wilkerson in particular, that's a big, big deal, because you're talking about a big body, kind of Alabama-style defensive end that can play that strong side end position with some length and girth. And he looked pretty decent in spot play last year, as he was sort of figuring things out. But basically... The word is that, you know, we should be pretty happy with what's going on at the defensive end position. Some other reports have come out, and I'll just reinforce those, that center looks like it's going to be okay. Eberle is the floor for 2017. He may not be able to hang on to that job, and if he doesn't, that's a good sign. He was pretty good in 2016, despite what lots of so-called Twitter experts and lots of fans will tell you. Eberle was actually pretty good in 2016. Yes, centers often get pushed back a little bit, but he was good. He was competent at that position, and it looks like competent or good is going to be the floor for that position in 2017, because both Bavion Johnson and Baselli are basically they're going to be. Really pushing for that position, and both have some talent there. Now to a couple of the question marks. Linebacker is still a little bit of a question mark. They're still having to work out some kinks there. And, you know, again, we'll know a little bit more after scrimmages and so on, but linebacker still needs to improve. And the big concern at this point, the big concern remains left tackle. Ethan Frith being the main, the guy who's lined up as the starter over the first week, that for a lot of people around the program is not inspiring a bunch of confidence. And I think the hope has to be that someone like Josh Ball spends the offseason getting stronger and ultimately wins the job. I mean, he's showing good potential, and he's moved up and is starting to get some reps. But at this point, that left tackle position is wide open, and nobody really knows what's going to happen there. That's the one that we're going to have to keep an eye on over the course of the spring. But all in all, reports out of the first week are positive. Just going to have to see what happens in terms of the scrimmages and how tough this team wants to be, how much they want to hold each other accountable and play physical football. But overall, I think those are positive reports to be able to bring to you guys after week one of the spring. Okay, that's going to do it for us here for the Unconquered podcast today. Now, before we get out of here, just a reminder, you can follow me on Twitter at Doc Staples. You can also follow Seminole Sports Radio at Seminoles Radio for the latest on FSU sports. And, of course, make sure to catch the next podcast. We're going to continue covering spring practice, addressing a few topical issues here and there. You can also, if you have not done so, please rate us, give us 5-star ratings on iTunes, and tell a friend on social media. There's still lots of people that don't know about this podcast, even though we are now in our 5th season. So plenty of work to do on that front. This has been the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio of eSporto Channel. I'm Jason Staples. Thanks for listening. I made this.